All right. Well, thanks for coming along tonight. And thanks to King & Wood Mellisons for giving us this fine facility where Richard Miles makes his third appearance at the Sydney Institute. He was here in opposition days, as I recall. He gave our annual, a very successful lecture, our annual lecture at the end of 2022, and here again tonight. So you know him well. He was been the member for Corio since 2007, and of course Deputy Prime Minister and Minister for Defence. And as I recall, our topic today is Australia's strategic situation. Okay, or something like that. Many thanks.
Well, thank you, Jared. Hopefully, is that all right? So vanity has stopped me from wearing glasses, which means I've now got a speech which is colloquially in my office referred to as being in Miles font 12, but it is so thick that it's like those cards that you spin which have moving characters if you spin them. So this looks like it's going for about 3 hours, but you'll find that I'll be doing this so quickly. Anyway, it is great to begin. It's great to be here. So let me start by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we meet tonight, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and pay my respects to elders past and present. And can I also pay my respects to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander men and women who have served our nation throughout our history and continue to do so to this very day. It's great to be back here at the Sydney Institute, and I'd particularly like to thank Jared and Anne Henderson for having me again here this evening. When I was sworn in as the Minister for Defence on the 1st of June in 2022, I was the 8th person to have held the office over the last 9 years. During the Abbott, Turnbull, Morrison government, there were 7 different defence ministers churning at a rate of 1 every 18 months. Consistency of government action was absent. There was a strategic void, and chaotic, politically driven decision-making filled the space for almost a decade. During the Rudd-Gillard government, the need for the replacement submarine to the Collins class had been identified and work was well underway. And then as the coalition took over in 2013, Australia went in and then out of a submarine deal with Japan. We went in and then out of a submarine deal with France. And the consequence of this indecision was that a 10-year capability gap opened up in respect of our most important and potent military platform. For decades, a tenet of Australian strategic thinking had been that if anyone meant our country harm, we would be given a 10-year warning. The 2020 Defence Strategic Update rightly observed that our strategic circumstances had deteriorated to such a point that Australia now sat within that 10-year threat window. And yet, the Coalition took no action. The Royal Australian Navy's surface fleet was the oldest since the end of the Second World War. From the time of the Defence Strategic Update until the 2022 election, the number of personnel in the ADF actually shrank. And programs were left to run over time and over budget, such that by the time the coalition left office, 28 major projects were running a total of 97 years over time. In place of real funding for defence, the coalition adopted the habit of making large defence announcements without the money to turn these announcements into reality. A $35 billion guided weapons and explosive ordnance enterprise with only $1 billion allocated towards it. An increase in the size of the ADF through to 2040 with only a fraction of the necessary funds to make it happen. We now know that from 2016 through until 2022, the coalition effectively cut defence funding by almost $20 billion. And that's not spin, it's detailed in black and white on page 95 of the Defence Strategic Review. And the result of this practice was that the Integrated Investment Program was massively and unsustainably overprogrammed, making effective defence planning impossible. During the Abbott Turnbull Morrison years, there was a complete absence of leadership. Billions of dollars were wasted and a decade was lost, right when Australia was facing the most complex strategic circumstances since the end of World War II. The unavoidable fact is that the Liberals were one of the worst defence governments in our nation's history at a time when Australia could least afford it. In coming to office, the Albanese government faced a volatile and complex strategic environment. 30 years ago, the grim realities of the Cold War gave way to the optimistic assumption that ideological competition had ended and that the world was on an irreversible trajectory toward economic integration and political liberalisation. That optimism now looks like wishful thinking. The post-Cold War era has come to an end, and in its place an intense strategic competition, principally between the US and China, and it will shape the world to come. Our region will not be immune from this dynamic. In fact, we are at the very centre of it. And this competition is being accompanied by even greater investments in conventional and, regrettably, non-conventional forces. Recorded military spending in the Indo-Pacific region has increased by almost 50% in the past 10 years, with China engaging in the largest non-conventional, or rather largest conventional military build-up in the world since the Second World War. In the year 2000, China had 6 nuclear-powered submarines. By the end of this decade, they will have 21. In the year 2000, China had 57 major warships. By the end of this decade, they will have 200. Now, these investments are shifting the balance of military power in new and uncertain ways. We are in an environment where the risk of miscalculation has increased and the consequences are ever more severe. And as China's strategic and economic weight grows, it is seeking to shape the world around it. And for a country like Australia, this represents a challenge because we are an island trading nation. We have an increasing reliance on trade for our national income. In 1990, 32% of our GDP came from trade. By 2020, that had risen to 45% of our GDP. And the physical manifestation of that trade are our sea lines of communication. The rules of the road at sea are everything for us. We are deeply invested in the existing global rules-based order, such as the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, and ideas like freedom of navigation. And when this rules-based order is placed under pressure, our national interest is deeply engaged. Of course, Australia values the most constructive and the most productive relationship with China that we can have. And this has underpinned the steps to stabilise our relationship with China that the Albanese government has taken since coming to government. And we are now seeing this reflected in the removal of trade impediments between our two countries. Yet the way this era of great power contest will unfold is unclear, and the outcome of the contest is uncertain. What is manifestly clear is that Australia and all the countries of the Indo-Pacific have a vital interest in maintaining a region where state sovereignty is protected, international law is followed, the global rules-based order is respected, and nations can make decisions free from coercion. Now, the mess that our government inherited, combined with the seriousness and of the challenge of the moment, demanded that from the outset of our government, we engaged in foundational thinking. Simply moving forward in accordance with a passive assumption that this is how things have always been done was a recipe for continued failure. To remedy the past and to properly plan for the future, we had to ask fundamental questions about what sort of a defence force Australia needed to enable us to maximise our agency over our destiny. In a sense, we needed to undertake a root and branch review of defence And while this has drawn criticism from some, we make no apology for it. In coming to government almost 2 years ago, the Albanese government has sought to bring a quiet sense of determination to our assessment and our response to our strategic environment. At the time of the election in May of 2022, AUKUS was an important idea by which Australia would acquire a conventionally armed nuclear-powered submarine capability in partnership with the UK and the US. But it was not much more than an idea. How it would happen was unclear. The capability gap in our submarines remained unresolved. Less than a year later, our government had announced the pathway by which our nuclear-powered submarine capability would become a reality. In reaching an agreement with the US for acquiring three Virginia-class submarines a decade earlier than planned, our submarine capability gap had been closed. In reaching an agreement with the United Kingdom that both countries would construct the same class of future submarines, we ensured that the risk of this huge endeavour would genuinely be shared. AUKUS was now real. And in the year since the AUKUS announcement, progress has been happening at a pace. The Australian Submarine Agency has now been established. The first tranche of AUKUS legislation has passed the Parliament. Land swaps with South Australia have occurred, enabling work to begin at the Osborne Naval Shipyard in Adelaide for the establishment of the future submarine production line and the future training academy. Infrastructure work is underway at HMS Stirling in Perth in preparation for the establishment of the Submarine Rotational Force West later this decade. And while many said it would never happen, the US has delivered the legislation to enable the transfer to Australia of both nuclear-powered submarines and, importantly, know-how. Around 20 sailors and officers are well advanced in their specialised nuclear-powered submarine training in the US and in the UK. Over 50 workers have been placed or are currently placed in the US and the UK building up their skills. And last month, we announced Australia's selection of our sovereign submarine build and sustainment partners, a critical step in an endeavour that will provide around 20,000 highly skilled jobs for Australians for decades to come. In our first 100 days, we commissioned the Defence Strategic Review, the most significant review of Australia's defence strategy, capability, planning and resourcing in more than 35 years. And less than 12 months ago, alongside the Prime Minister, we released the government's response to that review. At its heart is an assessment that we needed a more lethal, integrated and focused Defence Force to respond to Australia's complex strategic circumstances. The review was unambiguous in saying to achieve this, we needed to move away from a business as usual approach. We started delivering the review's recommendations immediately with six initial priorities of action, including advancing our nuclear-powered submarine capability, enhancing our long-range strike capabilities, hardening our northern bases, investing in our personnel, boosting our innovation, and driving our partnerships with the region. As a consequence of the DSR, the government commissioned an independent analysis of Navy's surface combatant fleet capability. And in response to that, we have released a blueprint for a larger and more lethal surface combatant fleet for our Navy. And this includes an additional $11.1 billion over the next decade to modernise and more than double the size of our future surface combatant fleet. This foundational thinking has also underpinned our defence industry policy enshrined in the Defence Industry Development Strategy, which my colleague Pat Conroy released earlier this year. The DIDS articulates for the first time the defence industrial base Australia will need in order to meet the changing strategic circumstance which is outlined in the DSR. Now, translating the recommendations of the DSR into a new direction for our Defence Force has required thoughtful, necessary, but difficult change. not only have we needed to recast the way we think about our capability, posture, and preparedness, but importantly, we've had to work out how to pay for it. A key recommendation of the DSR was to do away with the intermittent defence white papers and replace them with a biennial strategic update, the National Defence Strategy. Accompanying this would be a ground-up rebuild of Defence's 10-year procurement schedule, the Integrated Investment Program. The DSR called for the first National Defence Strategy to be released this year, and that will happen in the coming weeks. While the 2024 National Defence Strategy will largely reflect the DSR, the 2024 IIP will outline for the first time the government's capability plan to shift the ADF to an integrated, focused force consistent with the DSR. A signature of the first term of the Albanese government has been a determined effort to revitalise our regional engagement and strengthen our bilateral relationships. Australia seeks security in our region, and we aim to support the security of our region through our defence cooperation, our regional presence, and our deterrence capabilities. In the Pacific, we have invested in enabling Pacific-led responses to Pacific security challenges. We seek to be the Pacific's partner of choice. We are elevating our security partnerships, signing a bilateral security agreement with Papua New Guinea, a status of forces agreement with Fiji, and the Australia-Tuvalu-Falapili Union. Australia's partnerships in Southeast Asia also remain critical to our shared security interests, as the recent Australian-ASEAN summit underscored. We will soon finalise a defence cooperation agreement with Indonesia, which will deepen our relationship in a transformational way. We are increasingly ambitious in our engagement with the Philippines and with South Korea. In October of 2022, we signed the updated Australia-Japan Joint Declaration on Security Cooperation. This has taken our relationship with Japan to a new level, and it is being given expression in practical ways. After our groundbreaking reciprocal access agreement came into force last year, Australian F-35 aircraft have deployed to Japan, and Japan's F-35s have deployed to Australia. Defence cooperation with India saw 2023 be a year of firsts. Australia's hosting of Exercise Malabar, the first visit to Australia by an Indian submarine, India's first maritime patrol aircraft deployment to Cocos and Keeling Islands, and the first trilateral sale between Australia, India, and Indonesia. Our unique defence relationship with Singapore has gone from strength to strength. We are facilitating increased military training by Singapore in Australia. In the process, our relationship continues to be characterised by a deepening trust. And beyond our immediate region, we're doing more with France and have modernised our defence partnership with the UK by establishing for the first time a status of forces agreement. Of course, central to all our work is our alliance with the United States. And we continue to expand, evolve, and innovate our defence cooperation with the US in areas like maritime patrol, logistics, and sustainment. Indeed, just last week, the 13th rotation of the United States Marines arrived in Darwin. And at AusMin last year, we agreed to progress significant infrastructure upgrades in Australia's north to support this growing force posture cooperation. Our cooperation with the US, including trilaterally with the UK, is increasingly paying dividends in terms of an enhanced industrial base and technology collaboration. And this has seen a greater focus on rapidly building the industrial foundations and infrastructure needed to underpin a domestic guided weapons and explosive ordnance industry. And proof of this was evident when we signed a $37.4 million contract last year with Lockheed Martin Australia to begin local manufacturing of guided multiple launch rocket system missiles from 2025. The government is also implementing a program of advanced technology cooperation under AUKUS Pillar 2, that will provide greater access to the very best solutions across three highly advanced industrial bases. And crucially, just last week, the Australian Parliament passed legislation to strengthen our already robust export control framework in support of the establishment of an export licence-free environment between AUKUS partners. This is legislative reform of profound significance, enabling unprecedented levels of scientific, technological, and industrial cooperation between Australia and the United States and the United Kingdom. These types of industry and technology initiatives underscore a shared commitment to combining strengths and pooling resources across sovereign borders in support of shared security goals. Our ability to co-innovate, to co-invest, and to co-produce today with key partners will determine who wins the battle for military advantage tomorrow. And this latticework of partnerships is critical to Australia's security, the collective security of the region in which we live, and our ability to deter conflict. So we've engaged in the foundational thinking. We've taken the first critical steps to put this thinking into action and deepened our relationships with our partners. But all of this has been in pursuit of a clear strategic goal: transforming our future capability to survive in a much less certain world. In pursuing this goal, we need to ensure the great power competition does not tip over into confrontation. Now, some commentators have been fixated on the precise level of Australia's defence capability in the short term in the event of the worst case contingency. This analysis lacks wit. It misses the point that no middle power in the Indo-Pacific is solely capable of developing or deploying the scale or breadth of military forces that powers like China and the US can. This is obviously not the strategic cat that we are trying to skin. Australia's challenge lies in the future beyond this, and here we must invest in the next generation capabilities the ADF needs to address the nation's most significant military risks in the cyberspace and missile age. In simple terms, this means building a more potent defence force capable of deterring any potential adversary from taking actions against Australia or our interests. It involves being able to signal a credible ability to hold a potential adversary at risk further from our shores. It means having the capability to engage in impactful projection through the full spectrum of proportionate response. It means Australia being more self-reliant as our strategic circumstances continue to become more complicated and our region becomes less predictable. It also means Australia contributing with partners to collective efforts to deter broader regional contingencies that would be disastrous for us and for our region. Russia's brutal invasion of Ukraine gives us an example of what it looks like when the global rules-based order is directly challenged. We cannot afford a similar outcome in our region. Now, to be crystal clear, effective regional deterrence is not a synonym for military or economic containment. This is neither possible nor is it desirable. Instead, we seek, with our partners, a favourable regional strategic balance that ensures no country might ever conclude the benefits of conflict outweigh the costs. But this balance won't happen on its own. As the DSR made clear, defending Australia in the future will require integrated, focused force with the ability to deter a potential adversary from projecting force against Australia, including by being able to hold its assets at risk at greater distance from our shores. But getting the hard power equation right is only part of the picture. For Australia, deterring conflict in the strategic environment we face requires a new approach, one that harnesses all elements of our national power. And that is why the concept of national defence will underpin the inaugural National Defence Strategy. First articulated in the DSR, national defence is a coordinated, holistic approach to defending Australia. It encompasses a broad set of initiatives, ranging from hard power defence capability to industry resilience and supply chain security. But most importantly, it comprehends that our nation's front line is our diplomacy, and that our future security can be found in continuing to invest in an inclusive regional order in which trade and investment integration expands, not shrinks. Ultimately, however, our strategy will only be as effective as our ability to deliver it. History will judge us not by what we say, but by what we do. And you can only do if you properly fund. In last year's budget, the government committed an additional $30 billion in defence spending over the next 10 years. This is real money that has been determined through all the cabinet processes and allocated to defence. The first part of that additional funding will be reflected over the forward estimates in this year's budget. Earlier this year, the government announced a further increase in defence spending of $11.1 billion in connection with Navy's service fleet, and this included $1.7 billion additional spending over the forward estimates. Now, the result of these two decisions is that defence's funding will now reach around 2.4% of GDP by 2033-34. The defence budget we inherited from the Liberals was on track to be around 2.1% of GDP over a similar timeframe. This increase in defence spending is of historic proportions. It represents tens of billions of real additional dollars being directed to defence. And it remains unclear where the opposition stands on increasing defence funding, but we would welcome their commitment and bipartisan support to give defence the certainty it needs to plan for our strategic circumstances. But not only will we be growing the defence budget, we will also be ensuring a greater quality of spend. And this includes through our commitment to a minimum viable capability approach to acquisition and establishing processes that minimise the burden of working with defence. It also means bringing the management of the defence budget back into order. Our government inherited a defence budget that was at historically high levels of overprogramming. This included $42 billion in additional defence spending without any additional allocation in the Commonwealth budget. In some years, in the forward estimates, that overprogramming reached 30 to 40%. That means that for every $100 defence had to spend, it was planning to spend $140. Or in other words, more than a quarter of what defence had planned to buy or deliver, it had no money for. Overprogramming the budget, to some degree, does make sense. It involves the principle of managing a queue. A doctor's practice, for example, will book two patients at the beginning of each day to create a small queue. And this means that if a patient is late or doesn't turn up, the doctor will always have another patient to see. It means that when you turn up for your 3 o'clock appointment, you invariably have to wait, but it also means the doctor's time is fully occupied, and provided the queue is not too long, everyone is ultimately seen. Similarly, with complex defence projects, there will inevitably be delays in some and overruns in others. A small queue of projects ensures that defence procurement can keep happening despite these delays. History has shown that the sweet spot is about 20% overprogramming. That is to say, if you plan to spend $120 in defence, then you'll end up spending about $100. But at 30 to 40% overprogramming, which is where the Liberals had taken us, the numbers stopped adding up. It's the equivalent of turning up to your 3 o'clock doctor's appointment and not being seen at all. In a defence context, the consequences and costs of unsustainable overprogramming are profound. Every time A future program is announced. Even if the required money is not allocated, the Defence Department establishes a team to manage the program and industry starts employing people in prospect of the program. Now, that's fine if the project will eventually happen, even if it is a little late. But when everyone knows that the numbers don't add up, that not all projects can happen, then everyone is just waiting for the eventual train wreck. And in this train wreck, no one knows which projects will survive and whether sunk costs will ever be recovered. It is costly for industry and ultimately it's dishonest. It is devastating for defence morale and it makes clear future planning impossible. The practice must stop and our government intends to stop it. But to do so means making hard decisions even in the context of a rapidly growing defence budget. Now, the 2024 IAP will continue to prioritise the capability investments needed to develop an integrated focused force. But the IAP will also include tough but necessary decisions to divest, delay or rescope projects that do not support this integrated and focused force. And these decisions will be in addition to the tough choices already made by this government. For example, reducing the number of infantry fighting vehicles from 450 down to 129. This reprioritisation will enable the government to accelerate projects that will have the greatest impact on our strategic objectives, to deter any potential adversaries from actions against our interests. And most importantly, our government is committed to establishing a glide path over the next few years by which we return over programming back towards 20%. By greatly increasing defence spending and greatly improving the quality of the defence spend, we will greatly enhance our nation's capability to determine our own future. In the coming weeks, the National Defence Strategy will outline fundamental reforms to our approach and planning, force generation, posture, structure and preparedness, and international engagement. It will outline defence's contribution to the concept of national defence, which recognises Australia will deploy all levers of national power to make Australia more stable, secure and resilient. The 2024 National Defence Strategy and Integrated Investment Program will represent the next steps in this government's commitment to building a coherent defence policy agenda, one marked by strong foundations and hard decisions. It will provide a clear-eyed and prioritised approach to protecting against military threats to Australia and our immediate region. It will provide a disciplined, responsible and credible approach to funding defence, and it will represent a comprehensive end to the business-as-usual approach to defence that we inherited from the previous government. With consistent and clear leadership, articulating a consistent and clear vision with the determination to follow it through, together we can secure Australia. Thank you.
Many thanks to the Deputy Prime Minister for a comprehensive and wide-ranging account. And so we come to questions and discussion. So if you just come back here and we'll start. Thanks for a very wide discussion tonight, but would it be fair to interpret what you said tonight as into the long term, and you're talking about the long term, or the medium to long term, a downgrading of army and an upgrading of naval and aircraft or air defence forces?
No, I wouldn't accept that. There is certainly, there is certainly an upgrading of our Navy, so that part I definitely accept. What we will be doing with having our nuclear-powered submarine capability is really, in many respects, the biggest single leap in our military capability, you know, arguably since the establishment of the Navy back in 1913. But I think in terms of both the Army and the Air Force, our focus is on projection. As I said in the speech, what we need to be doing is building impactful projection through the full spectrum of proportionate response. What this will see is a much more mobile Army, an Army that we can move around our region. it imagines that the defence of Australia doesn't really mean that much unless we have the defence of our region and we make our contribution to the collective security of the region in which we live. We don't see that the future is about fighting a land war on the Australian continent. We do see that what we need with our army is to be making our contribution to regional security. And so in that sense, actually, we're enhancing army's ability to be more mobile. And that same logic would apply in relation to the capabilities that we seek to bring to bear with our Air Force. And again, you know, underpinning all that impactful projection, if we think about that, long-range strike missiles form a key part of the capabilities that we're seeking to enhance. And whilst that applies to Navy, it very much applies to Army and Air Force as well.
Thanks. I should have said earlier, questions broadly on the topic. Jonathan.
In the days when Rex Patrick was in the Senate, he used to talk about the difficulty of actually sending our submarines out to sea, because let's face it, who wants to be a submariner? And with nuclear submarines, which have the capability of staying underwater for longer, it's an even more unpleasant lifestyle. So what is our current capacity in terms of the submariners?
Again, I don't accept the entire premise of that. There's no doubt that being a submariner is a challenge, but there's also no doubt that when you meet submariners, they love the job that they do. And I've had the experience of spending time with our submariners, being on HMS Rankin, one of the Collins-class submarines, overnight. And what becomes really clear is that it is it's a unique working environment. There are huge opportunities that come with it, and people love doing it. But I think the challenge going forward, and I should say, sorry, in relation to nuclear-powered submarines, you are right, they will be able to stay underwater for longer, which is obviously why we are seeking to acquire that capability. The submarine is much bigger. I mean, I've been on a Virginia, I've been on a Collins-class submarine, so you can tell the difference. I think there is a challenge in growing our submariner workforce. We have time to do it, but that time starts now. And the point I would make and did make in the speech is that we have officers and submariner crews who are working right now in gaining experience on nuclear-powered submarines in the US. We will be providing that opportunity in both the US and the UK. That is part of the arrangement that we've reached with the US and the UK in terms of AUKUS and Australia acquiring this capability. And we're confident that, in fact, we will be able to grow the submariner force, and that there'll be something to encourage people to be part of that force. I mean, this is it genuinely is an exciting opportunity to serve your country.
So we're up here and then over there. Yes, up here at the back. Yep.
Minister Oliver Compton-Warner from Telstra. Thank you for the speech and congratulations on the progress you've made. It feels like the difference between a cyber war versus a traditional war is fading. How do you think about cyber war versus traditional physical war?
When you say it's fading, what do you mean?
And the two almost sort of coming together as one.
Well, if what you're saying is that cyber is now a contemporary domain of warfare, that's definitely true, and we are very focused on that. We've got more of our Defence Force personnel engaged in cyber, and through the Australian Signals Directorate, which would be our key capability in the cyber domain. That is an agency which is growing rapidly, and where we are investing tens of billions of dollars in increasing our capability there. So we certainly see, and again, I referred to it in the speech, that cyber is one of the key domains of, well, not just future warfare, but warfare today. And we need to be making sure that we are as resilient as we can be in terms of our cyber defences, and as capable as we can be in terms of what we bring to bear in that domain. I think one of the things, though, that comes with it, which is relevant to how we think about our strategic landscape and conflict, is that whereas in the traditional domains of air, land and sea, our geography is hugely consequential. You know, we are an island surrounded by oceans, and we have distance, and that gives us a degree of protection. Of course, the cyber domain knows no geography at all. And that completely changes the way in which we need to be thinking about what capability we bring to bear.
Michael.
Richard, thank you for a very comprehensive and coherent speech about government defence projections. I wonder if you could comment about the mega defence project and smaller project and the expertise required to manage all of that. I detect, perhaps from your speech tonight and other statements, a bit of dissatisfaction about the Defence Department capability and the general defence expertise, and major projects often require rethinking of what expertise is required. And I wonder if you could share your thoughts about how you think about the procurement, the expertise, the management of all those ambitious programs you've outlined.
Yeah. Thank you, Michael. And it's a really good question. Look, actually, I think there is really significant expertise within the Department of Defence in respect of dealing with really large projects. I mean, that they that has been, in many ways, their bread and butter over a long period of time. I think it is less a question of expertise and more a question of what philosophy is brought to bear in the execution of that expertise, which I think goes to the question of the timeliness and the you know, acting within budget of major projects. Minimum viable capability is, I think, a really critical concept which was articulated in the Defence Strategic Review. I mean, what it's really making clear is that when you put additional bells and whistles on any given platform, it comes with cost, increased design, and greater risk in terms of time blowout. And so if you want to deliver things on time and on budget, you know, the right philosophy is minimum viable capability. And so I think it's not about expertise, it's really about how we think about it and in a sense the job we therefore ask our folk to do. I do think that we need to be more nimble, particularly in the way in which we are dealing with small and medium companies, and if you like, smaller projects and capabilities which are not of the same order of magnitude in terms of dollars, but can be clearly really impactful. I mean, I think one of the things that we have seen play out in Ukraine is just how potent asymmetric capabilities can be thought through the prism of cost, meaning very cheap platforms are having devastating impacts on very expensive platforms. So it's that asymmetry which is leading us all to think about you know, what is the kind of full breadth of capability that we need to bring to bear. I mean, I do think we are going to need nuclear powered submarines. That's a very big platform. That's going to cost a lot of money, but it will be incredibly important in terms of our ability to project power. But at the same time, you know, I think there's a whole suite of smaller platforms which are actually quite cheap, a lot of them in the autonomous domain, which can have great potency as well. And that is a bit of a new frontier, you know. And so I think, you know, there's no criticism here. I just think it's a case that all of us are learning how to get that capability into action much quicker, and we need to be doing that much quicker. But I guess what I would be saying to you is, you know, this is a problem that we are very much thinking about a lot, and trying to make sure that we are keeping up to speed. And I think, as I say, I think the war in Ukraine is really kind of turbocharging this kind of dimension of how we think about warfare.
If you want to get the corporate, get your hand up. There's a question there. Yeah. Can't hear you. No, can't hear you.
Oh, sorry. Thank you very much, Minister. really interesting conversation. I just wondered, has your government considered the possibility of, when Donald Trump becoming the next president, would he likely to honor the AUKUS agreement and
okay.
Australia,
okay, we got it. All right. So, a question about the US administration.
Trump,
yeah.
Yep.
No,
okay, we got it. Okay. Yep.
Look, I mean, firstly, obviously, we deal with the US administration, which is in power now, and we'll continue to deal with them. And we are very pleased, more than pleased, actually. I mean, I think that the constructive nature of the way in which we are working with the Biden administration is as good as any working relationship between our two nations in the history of the alliance. We clearly think about, whatever contingencies might arise post-November. I think the way to answer that question is that when we look at the legislation that went through the United States Congress at the end of last year, legislation which provided for the sale of the Three Virginias to Australia, but legislation which reduced the barriers between our two defence industry landscapes or ecosystems in a way which we've never seen before, and it really is completely transformational for the way in which we relate to the United States. All of that legislation was supported across the American political spectrum, including Republicans who supported Donald Trump. So I think we do have a sense that looking to the future, AUKUS is something, and the arrangements that we've reached under AUKUS is something that will be honoured by future American governments, as I think they will be by future Australian governments and future UK governments. What gives us a sense of real confidence that AUKUS will survive the journey, I think it's fundamentally that it's in the strategic interests of the three countries, and that's ultimately what drives it. But that is then reflected in the fact that it has bipartisan support, again, in all three countries. So, of course, we think about the future, but actually we approach the future with a sense of confidence about the arrangements that we've reached.
A question with a bit of a magazine quality. The last few days, on the web, there have been headlines, Australians training the Ukrainians to beat the Russians. We've got a group of men over there, are they over there, and what's the agreement and what are they doing? Just to fill in the blanks.
Well, we've had for some time Australians in the UK training recruits of the Ukrainian Armed Forces. I had the privilege, really, of being able to see that happen firsthand in February of last year. And so it's really been in place now for much more than a year. And we're committed to continuing that training, which is a UK-led initiative through the course of this year. It's really important. I mean, it's important because the Ukrainian Armed Forces now is very much a citizen's force. The people I met a year ago, literally a month before I met them, had been clerks, truck drivers, construction workers, with as much military experience as me, and that's none. And yet they were facing, in a completely eyes open, in a totally heroic way, the prospect of their own mortality in a matter of months because of what they believed in. And certainly having, met those Australians who were doing the training then and met them on their return to Australia, I think our servicemen and women are doing us proud, but they are also feeling that they are engaging in, maybe the most significant thing that they will do wearing Australia's uniform. So it is something we are doing, we're committed to keeping on doing it, and we're very proud to do it.
There's a question here.
Thanks for the talk, Minister. Is Australia or Defence able to benchmark itself against other OECD nations as to how effectively it converts expenditure to increase capability in defence?
That's a good question. There are various benchmarks around. I think it is fair to say that translating big defence projects into action is a challenge for every country that does them. I think one of the things that becomes clear is that in order, you know, you get capabilities when you stick at it. And so every big complex project has its moments. You've got to work through them. We're very mindful of that. But the key countries that we work with, our peer countries, face similar challenges to us, and we all look at ways in which we can do this better and more effectively, and certainly we need to be doing that going forward.
There's a question here. We're getting towards the end.
The overcleaning you referred to, you can't just be what type of reactions are you getting within defence, within this sort of sharpening of the focus, their level of are they on board with all of this? Or?
Yeah, I think, it's again, really good question. I mean, they are. What I said before is the overprogramming of the defence budget, which as I tried to go through in some detail, and it's a topic which doesn't get a lot of airtime. And if I'm being really honest, it's not something I would have been able to articulate in the way that I can now when I first came to this job. But where I'm at now, I cannot tell you how significant this is and how significant it is that we get this under control. There is a legitimacy to having a degree of overprogramming in the way in which I described. It is the principle of managing a cube. But where where overprogramming has got to right now, the numbers are not adding up. And what it means is that, you know, one of the consequences I described is that it really is really bad for defence morale. I mean, people are working on programs and they are not sure whether those programs are ever going to come to fruition because the numbers just don't add up. And so when we say, so if anything, you know, defence have been making clear to us, if we're to be, when there's really a call to action, that if we're to be a serious government, we need to tackle this. And it's so easy when the lead times are so long and when, you know, you're churning a defence minister every 18 months, to not have to worry about this because it's going to be somebody else's problem 10, 15 years from now. But obviously, that's not going to cut it in terms of the strategic circumstances that we face and the place where we need to place Australia. That's why we really are determined to deal with this issue now. It does mean making hard decisions. It does mean taking some programs and not going ahead with them. It means reprofiling some, it means delaying others, re-scoping them. But unless we do that, the numbers don't add up. But doing it is something which I actually think builds morale because people now know that what's going on is real. This is not make-believe money or make-believe announcements and hoopla. It's actually fair income. And whilst there are difficult decisions that you need to digest, at least there is a sense that what's happening is fair income and real. And I think, you know, I couldn't be happier with the response that we've received from within defence in respect of that. But when you think about it, that makes sense because it means that people are going to work each and every day with a sense of purpose about what they're doing.
Second last question here. But you've got to be brief because we're running to the end.
Mr. Miles, the head of the Defence Forces, General
Campbell,
recently remarked that there is no place, or words to the effect, there's no place in the Australian Army for exceptionalism. On reflection, does this mean that our VCs, our Victoria Crosses of the past, don't deserve the epithet exceptional? I would have thought they were.
Okay, we got it.
Yeah. Yep. So General Campbell made that comment in a particular context, and it was in the context of the Brereton report, which looked into the alleged events in Afghanistan. And the point that he was making was that every regiment, every unit within our defence force has its role. If you like, they are all special and they are all exceptional and they all play their part. When I heard General Campbell say that, and I very much agree with the sentiment that he's describing, he is really speaking to the idea of team, that we are of one, as one. And I genuinely believe, and this, you know, comes from someone who is a sports fan, and one of the fun things I get to do, having backed for Geelong all my life and representing that area, is I get to know that football club quite well. And when you think about what it does as a professional sporting organisation, its whole business is team, and they are very, you know, that they're an amazing organisation. But nothing I've seen at its best expression comes close to the expression of team that I've seen in the Defence Force. And General Campbell is really speaking to that idea. Now, I don't think that runs at odds with the idea that we seek to highlight moments of great bravery, which is what the Victoria Cross is. I think the inspiration that comes from those who have in a completely selfless way, in disregard to their own life, which is the idea behind the VC, have acted in a way to save others. He was not trying to make an argument that kind of recognition shouldn't occur. I think that recognition is actually really important. And the system of medals and honours and awards through the Defence Force does recognise individuals, but it serves as an inspiration to everyone on the team. But what he was saying is that particular units of the team are not more special than others. Everyone has the role to play, and team needs to be what we're about.
Final quick question. When you spoke for us at our annual dinner about a year and a half ago, you mentioned the problems with recruitment. You've got low unemployment.
Yeah.
You've got a lot of competing industries, a lot of competing for men and women with skills. How is that going in the ADF?
Yeah, good question again. Look, the answer... So glass half full is that, you know, we've taken a lot of steps to increase the quality of the offer for people in the Defence Force. We've put in place bonuses for those who continue their service. We've put in place a better offer in relation to housing. We're doing better, I think, in terms of the way in which the process of recruitment by which we are shortening the period from people's first expression of interest to the point where they're actually wearing a uniform. So we have made some concrete steps and changes, and that is being reflected in a reduction of the separation rate. In other words, retention is improving. And it is also starting to show up now in recruitment as well. That's glass half full. I guess glass half empty going forward is that to meet the challenge of what we seek to do in terms of growing the Defence Force through to 2040, we need to do better. And we need to be thinking about what we've managed to achieve so far and grow it further. I mean, when we came to office, we were... you know, what we had was a shrinking Defence Force. You know, retention was out, or the lack of retention was outstripping recruitment. We are starting to turn that around, but there is a way to go in this journey.
Many thanks.
Thank you.
Well, ministers are very busy people, cabinet ministers more so, and deputy prime ministers more so. So it's a great honour for us tonight that the deputy prime minister and the minister of defence has come to the Sydney Institute, giving us an important and wide-ranging address, and in a very democratic spirit, taking questions from people who are here and responding without notice. So we're very grateful you came today. We'll hope to see you again, but for tonight, well done. Thank you.